embracing Anabaptist values in the 21st century made my mind flit back to probably over 40 years ago. As a little boy looking at a real estate sign somewhere that said something about 21st century something. And I remember as a little boy just looking at that and puzzling what the 21st century is. And here my life is half gone and I'm still trying to figure it out. It's probably high time to start talking about the 22nd century if we're going to keep up that pace. So embracing Anabaptist values is not a new challenge, but our time is. It's 2025 now, and it's not 1893, or it's not 1944 or 1968. It's not even 1992. You know, those thresholds were important times for our fathers who could not have imagined the world we live in today. But we live in this one. They agonized at those crossroads, what's the right way to go? We live in 2025, where the world has been changed beyond recognition from their times, in a lot of ways, even from 1992. So where are we? Well, I think behind us, we've had a lot of chatter this year, haven't we? About 500 years, we have a 500-year heritage of Anabaptist identity behind us. Patchy, but amazingly resilient. We have around us a broad core of good families who live a sort of status quo conservative Mennonite practice. Although some seem a little concerned about not appearing too radically separate from American culture. And ahead of us, I see myself, you can disagree with this, but I see a significant wave of people under 29 years old, you can ask me about that, who seem less convinced than we are that a conservative Mennonite practice is a valid response to Jesus' invitation. If you will follow me, come after me, and deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow me. So do the test a little bit. I'm talking about placing ourselves in a timeline. Where are we? Where are you? How many of you have parents who made some kind of significant church affiliation shift during their married years? How many of you have parents like that? Okay. How many of you were baptized into a church fellowship other than this one? Okay. That's not so surprising. It's a newish group. How many of you have home congregations with a significant percentage of members who have arrived in the last 15 or 20 years? So you get the picture. It's inevitable that at this threshold of a restructured conference that we should look back, we should look ahead. What journeys, what victories, what losses, what gains, what travails and labors lie behind us? And the real question is, how have these things shaped us? How do they shape the labors given into your hands for the next 10 years, the next 20 years? Turn to John 4. This is our text. It's a fascinating story about Jesus with the woman at the well and the Samaritan village. The title of the sermon this morning is, "Ye Are Entered Into Their Labors." John 4, I'm going to start at 25. This is where Jesus was prompting her to think. "The woman saith unto him, I know that Messiah cometh, which is called Christ. When he is come, he will tell us all things. Jesus saith unto her, I that speak unto thee am he. And upon this came his disciples and marveled that he talked with a woman. Yet no man said, What seekest thou, or why talkest thou with her? The woman then left her water pot and went her way into the city and saith to the men, Come, see a man which told me all things that ever I did. Is not this the Christ? Then they went out of the city and came unto him. In the meanwhile, his disciples prayed him, saying, Master, eat. But he said unto them, I have meat or food to eat that ye know not of. Therefore said the disciples one to another, Hath any man brought him aught to eat? Jesus saith unto them, My meat is to do the will of him that sent me, and to finish his work. Note the word finish. Say not ye, there are yet 4 months, and then cometh harvest. Behold, I say unto you, lift up your eyes, and look on the fields, for they are white already to harvest. And he that reapeth receiveth wages, and gathereth fruit unto life eternal, that both he that soweth and he that reapeth may rejoice together. And herein is that saying true, one soweth and another reapeth. I sent you to reap that whereon ye bestowed no labor. Other men labored, and ye are entered into their labors. And many of the Samaritans of that city believed on him for the saying of the woman which testified, He told me all that ever I did. So when the Samaritans were come unto him, they besought him that he would tarry with them. And he abode there 2 days, and many more believed because of his own word, and said unto the woman, Now we believe, not because of thy saying, for we have heard him ourselves, and know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world. Now Jesus was here illustrating a proverb, one sows, another reaps. But he was illustrating it in the context of a Samaritan village, which was, you know, somewhat second class in a proper Jewish mind. And I want you to notice that in spite of what we think of this Samaritan woman, you know, she had some personal problems in her marriages, for example. But when Jesus was done talking to her about the living water and all this, she started to reveal some things that she had in her mind. What were they? I know that the Messiah is coming. How does she know that? How did the villagers come streaming out of the city and see Jesus and listen to him and say things like verse 42? We've heard him, and we know that this is indeed the Christ, the Savior of the world. Were the Samaritans expecting Jesus? Well, they must have been. They must have known all about the prophecies. They must have been ready to hear. And so here were Samaritans, mixed up people, all ready to listen. Because decades before this strange rabbi came to the well and started telling strange stories, decades before, centuries, maybe generations before, there were little children held at bedtime and told by Samaritan parents about the Jesus that's coming. The Messiah is going to come someday. We heard it from, you know, the more proper Jewish families and priests, maybe. They probably read to their children from Psalm 119 and from Micah and from Isaiah and David. The angel told Zacharias, you know who Zacharias was, John the Baptist's father, came to Zacharias and frightened him and said, you're going to have a son, and one of his big tasks is going to be to turn the hearts of fathers to children to make ready a people prepared for the Lord. So that when the Messiah comes, there was already going to be great preparation laid for his message. How many generations of faithful preaching prepared you to believe that Jesus is not an Oriental myth? Think about how long that had to be prepared so that when you were 12 years old or 14 or 16 and you made a decision for the Lord, how many centuries of preparation went into your receptiveness of that? And we'll unpack some more of this as we go here, how much of your pastoral work is with people others have prepared for the Lord. Much of it, isn't it? Well, point number one, Jesus came in the fullness of time to people prepared to believe the truth. Now, I know it didn't go so well for Jesus, did it? So you have to hold some of these things in tension in your mind. That's the definition of being an adult. But Galatians says that in the fullness of time, God sent forth his Son, made of a woman, made under the law. So the law and the prophets sowed I'm thinking about sowing and reaping now. The law and the prophets sowed sufficient truth. Turn to Luke 16. This is an unmistakable theme in the Gospels. Luke 16, 27, in the story of Lazarus. And remember how Lazarus was, the rich man was saying, I wish you'd send somebody to my family. Verse 27, then he said, I pray thee, therefore, Father, that thou wouldest send him to my father's house. For I have five brethren, that he may testify unto them, lest they also come into this place of torment. Abraham saith unto him, they have Moses and the prophets, let them hear them. And he said, nay, Father Abraham, but if one went unto them from the dead, they will repent. And he said unto them and to him, if they hear not Moses and the prophets, neither will they be persuaded, though one rose from the dead. And Jesus said in John's record, where Jesus said, search the scriptures, for they are they that testify of me. Had ye believed Moses, ye would have believed me. This is all through. And remember, whenever in the New Testament you hear the word scriptures, what are we talking about? We're talking about the Psalms and the Pentateuch, the Law of Moses. We're talking about Leviticus, of all things. We're talking about Jonah, Micah, Nahum. We're talking about those are the things that Jesus said when he talked on the way to those two men on the way to Emmaus. He says, and he started where? With Moses. He started back there in Numbers and Deuteronomy, and he started to explain about himself. And it says he expounded unto them in the scriptures all things concerning himself. And he would have had to stop at Malachi, right? So the law and the prophets sowed sufficient truth. It doesn't stop with Jesus. You have multiple references from Paul where he is in the early church in the book of Acts. And we have sentences like this that he tells King Agrippa at one point, I continue to this day witnessing to all people saying, none other things than that which is in Moses and the prophets. That's amazing. So maybe the Pentecost harvest, which was a miracle, wasn't it? 3,000 people believed. But turn to Acts 2. Just let your eyes scan that passage a little bit. I want you to notice something. Peter's bold sermon would have had plenty of places to start other than where he did. For example, nowadays, it's quite popular in certain evangelical circles to make sure you have a story. You have a story of dramatic turnaround in your life. Now, who had a bigger story than Peter? And what does he do when he wants to convince a several thousand person audience, which would be a marvelous time to tell a story, wouldn't it? He says, it shall come to pass in the last days that which was spoken by the prophet Joel. And he begins to speak out of the prophets. That's where the truth was. And it's almost as though his testimony about what his story was being with Jesus himself was almost a sort of aside, where he says at one place, Jesus came, and he was crucified, and he rose again, whereof we are witnesses. I saw it. And that's all he says. And he goes on to say, he quotes from the Psalms. That says, David, this is Christ who's going to be on the throne of David, and he speaks from that. So thousands of Jews, prepared by generations of the law and the prophets, understood on that day of Pentecost that the fullness of time had come. And so the miracle was less about speaking in tongues and more about the harvest of people made ready for the Lord. The early church reaped an abundant harvest among the Jewish people, at least, from the labors of faithful rabbis and priests for centuries before them. And you have to remember that just because Caiaphas was the high priest of their establishment, or their church, if you please, that didn't mean there couldn't be Simeons and Annas and Zachariases who were faithful in all things with the law and the prophets. Second point, the Anabaptist awakening was a harvest of seed sown faithfully through the Middle Ages. I'm rather of a mind with the historians who downplay the miracle of 1525 and and look instead at the origins of that time. Why did a pivotal time even happen like that? In the words of Swiss historian Ernst Müller, quote, "What the reformers presented was not so impressive because it was new. Instead, it was because the time was ripe to say publicly what lay in the hearts of thousands. The large multitude of the common people were the real reformers." End quote. Those Bernese farmers, not known for being given to novelty, at least if you pay attention to the Swiss stereotype, they didn't die gruesome deaths because they were attracted to some exciting new religious experiment. That would have been out of character for them. But they were able to bear torture because centuries of Christian piety had been carried through medieval Europe ever since the time of the early church. And the Holy Spirit enabled our fathers to bear that torture because their hearts had been prepared by faithful parents and grandparents long before 1525. What were some of those? Well, I have a few points. There were centuries of, quote-unquote, heretical spiritual movements. Some of them were heretical, it's true. But they dared to teach Jesus' literal Sermon on the Mount, for example, and reject church-state alliances of power. Müller calls them the old evangelical congregations. Some of them were sketchy, it's true. The Cathars, the Albigenses, the Waldensians, the Bohemian Brethren. He quotes this. He says there's a narrative from the year 1250. Okay, stop and place that. 1250? In the year 1250? There was almost no country in Europe in which these sects, these strange groups, could not be found, and they were identified by their simple way of life, their virtue, their moderation, and their objection to the oath. The Wiedertaufer, the Anabaptists, this is a quote made during the Reformation, "The Wiedertaufer are generally found at those places where the separatists had been in the Middle Ages." See, what I'm trying to say is that in those places in Europe, it wasn't new in 1525. I think another kind of influence, and you can contest this if you want to, but there were centuries of religious orders within the Catholic Church, Brethren of the Common Life, for example, in Holland. You think about very influential spiritual leaders such as Thomas A. Kempis. And I'm not going to vouch for all these people believe, but you think about a book like The Imitation of Christ. It was the second most influential book in Europe, maybe, behind the Bible. But what did it do? It invited people into the spiritual life, into the life of Bible study and meditation. And all of the reformers, Zwingli, Erasmus, yes, they were the magisterial reformers, but they were all first influenced by those spiritual influence, the Brethren of the Common Life and so on. That's what instigated some of their first Bible study and so on. Michael Sattler was an ex-Benedictine, the Benedictine orders, many other orders. I'm just saying that to some degree, we do not know how much the preaching of the Franciscan friars and the Benedictine monks and all of these other spiritual movements, however off track they were, it did prepare people who were ready to listen to the preaching of the Anabaptists when it came, when that time came. They said, yes, that's what the Bible says. We know that because we heard it from Grandpa and others. And so there was an influence there. You have the influence of the Gutenberg miracle. You know, when Bibles, yes, no, you couldn't afford them. No, the common people couldn't afford them. But when Bibles spread the word, again and again, you find in the story of Anabaptist history that the springing up of adult baptism and churches that were planted was coming out of the backs, or was coming out of communities where there were Bible study cells or Bible reading cells. Again and again, you find that in the history. And their interlocutors and the courts of that time were irritated by how Bernese farmers knew the scriptures. I know your mind might go to what Jesus said. I will give it to you in that hour what to say when you're called on the carpet, and that is true. I'm sure that miracle happened. But there's only one way to be able to know the scriptures well, right? What is it? You need to read them much. And they did. Leonard Bowens, remember? Leonhard Bowens, the Dutch bishop who was at the high tide of the early Anabaptist movement in Holland. It said he baptized over 10,000 people. And those were not people that Dirk Phillips or Menno Simons or any of these people had all carefully prepared out of some kind of heathen religion to be ready to say, I'll be baptized even if it means I'll be burned. No, these were people, as Jesus said, I sent you to reap whereon ye bestowed no labors. Third point, awakenings and revivals and church growth are always, to some extent, a reaping of other men's labors. The awakening in the Mennonite churches in the 1890s, for example, 1870s to 1900, I would posit that did not just happen because John F. Funk and John S. Kaufman and these men roused the people to action across Canada and America, and hundreds of families sort of somehow shook themselves and said, why don't we change our language and have Sunday schools and missions and go to Chicago and Tanganyika and be a relevant church? As though it was a brand new idea. I would say that there were thousands of 19th century God-fearing homes with parents that said to children, that taught the children what it means that in the kingdom we're called to be witnesses too, not just to escape fallen culture. The conservative withdrawals in the 1960s out of conference didn't just happen because we had some really charismatic, conservative-minded bishops like Eschbach and Schenck and others who said, oh, we need to stop this, and we're going to start new churches and so on. But hundreds of ordinary Mennonite families who had been raised in the conferences and still knew what the truth was were committed. They understood that scriptural ethics didn't just change because it's 1960 and a skinny prophet on the radio was singing, the times they are a-changin'. You think about the era that was there, and I did not live through that. I'm not speaking from experience. Come, mothers and fathers throughout the land, don't criticize what you can't understand. Your sons and your daughters are beyond your command. Your old road is rapidly aging. Please get out of the new one if you can't lend your hand. For the times, they are a-changing. That was the cultural environment of the 60s when these men were saying, okay, enough is enough. Enough is enough. Let's regroup here. That was the gospel of the times. And new church fellowships formed because parents had already been, to some extent, may I say, inoculated, prepared against the lure of self-expression because of the commandments that they had learned at mother's knee, maybe grandmother, grandfather. And what do we do with this? We have to understand this today that PMC today is somehow indefinably but surely strengthened today by what Lancaster Conference and EPMC and Weaverland Conference and the Amish Mennonites and the Ohio Whistler Churches and the Groffdale Conference and Virginia Conference have faithfully sown before us. Those seeds have, in some unknown way, because we don't know how these things work, but they've matured into faithful families in our churches. And who can measure the spiritual ballast that is providing at home in your church today? Who can measure? We don't. The statistics of conservative Mennonite, I'll call it affiliative migration, is a humbling story. It's also a somber one, because the old orders and the most conservative groups feed all the groups to the left of them, and the flow is almost 100% in one direction. And so we receive today much stabilizing influence from the Amish and Mennonites around and behind us. It is spiritual pride to ignore this, or worse, to reflect against those groups as though we have been somehow enlightened or liberated from the shackles of conservatism, as though replacing buggies and hats with trucks and phones and missions in Honduras has somehow, on average, resulted in families that are more successful at doing what Jesus said, come after me and deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. How's the self-denial going in our families, in our lifestyles? How's it going compared to the groups to the right of us, behind us, who didn't make the changes we made? How's it going? I'll tell you a story. My last memory, I was 19 years old. And I stopped in randomly at my grandfather Shirk's house. He was 82 years old. He didn't know I was coming. I knocked on the door. I walked in. And he was in a horse and buggy church, okay, an older church. I walked in. He was widowed. He was crippled. He was by himself in the kitchen. And on his lap was a stack of songbooks. And he had been singing to himself. And I walked in, I said, hi, Grandpa, and we talked a little bit, and it was only a few minutes, he said, you want to help me sing? He was 82, and he picked up a number in his German hymn book and began to sing several verses of several songs all the way through for me. He was not senile. He was completely serious. And I thought that my parents had left his church because it was somehow spiritually dead, and now I was in a conference that was somehow enlightened and alive. And here's Grandpa not talking about the weather or Bill Clinton or the beef prices or all of the other things. He was sitting here singing his German hymns. And he was completely serious about it. That was a moment that something changed in my mind. That I stopped and said, okay, so this is a little more complex than I thought it was. I'm humbled by that. I'm today receiving what Grandpa sowed. Point number four. Western culture worships the lie of the self-made man. The self-made man has been a staple of American identity ever since Ben Franklin went strolling down the streets of Philadelphia with a penny loaf under his hand looking to make a fortune and wound up helping to found a new republic. Only in America can a barefoot Abe Lincoln become the president. Only in America can a Michigan farm boy like Henry Ford revolutionize transportation for the world. And it hasn't stopped. Only in America can the son of alcoholic Appalachian rednecks make it to Harvard and to the White House today. And so this is deeply in our American, especially in our Western American culture, the idea, kind of like the Ragged Dick books of the past century where Horatio Alger, you know, these poor little New York City urchins on the streets, they learn to keep their shoes tied, and sure enough, they become successful bankers and Wall Street tycoons because of their self-discipline. And that was a prominent feature through from about 1850 to 1930 maybe, it's so deeply immersed in our culture, this idea that you can fancy yourself self-discovered, remade, reinvented, and never before like today has popular culture glorified the inventing of yourself. I do me is the theme of the internet. If you think about it, I'm me. I'm not dad or mom. I'm my own brand. It's so much a part of our pop culture and teen culture and fashion and academia and all of those places. We don't notice it much more than a fish notices water. It's just the air in which we live here, and it's so toxic to New Testament brotherhood. I tell you, it is absolutely toxic because it is 100% opposed to the model of brotherhood when you think that you're your own new man. American evangelicalism, and I want to be careful. I don't want to just fulminate against groups because there are faithful people there too. But much of the theme has championed, Jesus is doing amazing things through me. And people today, even in Anabaptist churches, can feel that they're not flourishing unless they're reinventing what their parents did. Now, to some degree, that is the province of youth. To some degree, we all do that. You know the old country song, me and Jesus, we got our own thing going. We don't need anybody to tell us what it's all about. Me and Jesus, we got it all worked out. That's the American culture, the view of Christianity for many of them. And today, the social and ecclesiastical inhibitions to starting a new fellowship with a group of families is about as low as it's ever been. The barriers to doing that. We ought to ponder this. What are the roots of that? Well, somewhere in there, I'll quote Frederick Douglass. You remember the escaped slave who became a statesman? There are no self-made men, and I'm going to say there are no self-made churches. That term implies an individual independence of the past and present which can never exist. Our best and most valued acquisitions have been obtained either from our contemporaries or from those who have preceded us. We have all either begged, borrowed, or stolen. We have reaped where others have sown, and that which others have strewn we have gathered. And so it is true, except the Lord build the house, we labor in vain. Remember, Simons himself was famous for saying, for other foundation has no man laid than that which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. But we should be humble about it, because the lure of believing that I can start over and I don't need what came before me is always present with us. Point number five, we are not better than our fathers. Now, I know this is dangerous territory. But remember that story in First Kings where Elijah's running from Jezebel, and he goes out in the wilderness and he sits down and he's so depressed. He's in this dark mood, and at some point he says, what's the use? I'm not better than my fathers. Well, it was true. And to say, when someone says to you, you're just like your dad, that's like a 5-word emotional stability test right there. When you're little, you wanted your cap to match dad's. When you're 17, you're afraid it does. But our fathers, for all their flaws, have planted seeds, tended the fields for a lifetime maybe for some of us, and gave it to us at harvest time. No matter how much you dislike the choices your dad made, you're probably a lot like him. And this is in this theme of reaping other men's labors. And it ought to, if we're of sound mind, and I know we have different stories. Some of our fathers haven't been faithful. We should reckon with that. We have to reckon with that. That hurts. But if we're of sound mind, we should, in our families, just think about a question like this. Do I live today? How many of you live today by the standards and lifestyles that your father stood for? Don't raise your hand, but think about that. Do you still? Or your grandfather? Has the change, if it's different, has it been positive growth for your family? Are you in a safer place today if you've changed? Has it been bearing good spiritual fruit in your teenage children? If you've changed, we inherit the labors of unremembered preachers and fathers who faithfully taught what voluntary discipleship is like in a fallen world. How many daily benefits am I reaping today because of the investment that happened at or over my father's knee? Maybe it was your mother. When I call to remembrance the unfeigned faith that is in thee, I'm sure it came from your grandmother Lois and thy mother Eunice. I'm persuaded it's in you too. That's how it works. Point number six, we reap much that is quietly sown by our companions. I don't know if all of you have companions. I don't know if we have single ordained men here or not, but if you go to try to do your business of serving the Lord in the church work without the help of your companion, sometimes you know that it doesn't work so well always. And I know that modern conveniences has helped a lot with that. But your wife holds you accountable because she, like nobody else, knows when you are preaching what you practice or not. She keeps you from doing more foolish things than you already do, which is a kind of fire insurance, I guess. She listens to you express your pastoral stresses intelligently, unlike your dog, who may be a more submissive listener, but completely unhelpful. That's a strength. Our feet are strengthened by the companions at our sides. We reap what they sow. Point number seven. We enter into the labors of our yoke fellows. I want you to turn to 1 Corinthians 3. This is real church life here. 1 Corinthians 3. Let's start in about 3. For you are yet carnal, Paul says to the Corinthian churches. For whereas there is among you envying and strife and divisions, are you not carnal? Walk as men, for while one saith, I am of Paul, another, I am of Apollos, are you not carnal? Who then is Paul? Who is Apollos? But ministers by whom you believed, even as the Lord gave it to every man. I have planted, Apollos watered, but God gave the increase. So then, neither is he that planteth anything, neither he that watereth, but God that giveth the increase. Now he that planteth and he that watereth are one, and every man shall receive his own reward according to his own labor, for we are laborers together with God, and you are God's husbandry, you are God's building, and so on. We'll stop there. But Paul is saying, don't be childish. One man, one preacher, one deacon just adds to the little bit of the field that was prepared a long time ago. Don't do this. We're mostly part of a team of shepherds in our flocks, serving under the chief shepherd. And the opportunity for rivalry is great, as it is for co-laboring. But even if we don't feel the temptation, the sometimes struggling sheep in the flock may try to trigger the rivalry because it's a diverting tactic to their own needs. And distressingly often in our churches, it works. And we need to be humbled, lean on our fellow team members. It's not just the ordained people. Think about all the brothers and sisters in your church. Maybe some faithful men and women in the congregation are doing as much as you are to feed the flock in unseen ways. They hold up your hands left and right like Aaron and Hur. And we can be tempted to try to keep most of the weight of our arms up ourselves instead of leaning on them and letting them feel how heavy our arms are. If you don't let them feel the weight of your arms, then brotherhood isn't working. Because you think you're a self-made man, you don't need their labors. Now, you don't think that pridefully. Maybe you think about that in a kind of good, responsible way. You know, I don't want to be a burden to anybody, I think is maybe the temptation for more of us. What kind of church would you have if it all depended on your labors and your sowing? Point number eight, depending on the contribution of others is a central theme of the kingdom. What hast thou that thou didst not receive? Paul said at one point. If thou didst receive it, why dost thou glory as if thou hadst not received it? Stanley Hauerwas, in the book Jesus Changes Everything, he said a couple of notes about church life that have been really sticking with me recently. Quote, "The object of the Sermon on the Mount is to create dependence, to force us to need each other." The object of the Sermon on the Mount is to force us to need each other. He says that the ethical standards in the Sermon on the Mount are all counter to what a believer could do for himself. So, for example, we love our enemies, we give away our money to the poor, we honor lifelong marriage commitments, we return good for evil. All of these things make us vulnerable, and they're very bad survival advice for lone wolves. You can't follow the Sermon on the Mount and be a lone wolf very successfully. It teaches us that which every joint supplieth. And so we enter into the labors of the faithful families in our congregations, even the ones that sometimes cause us heartache. We enter into their labors. Lewis, in Mere Christianity, he has a classic illustration where he talks about the nature of needing each other in the congregation. He says this, "The one really adequate instrument for learning about God is the whole Christian community, waiting for him together." And he uses the illustration. He said, what if you were at an observatory, maybe the McDonald Observatory or someplace, and there was this world-class telescope that was trained out on the skies, and this was $1 million thing to look into far galaxies, and you would go there to look out in the heavens, and some conceited person stands outside the observatory with a rusty old pair of binoculars, and he says, "Oh, I can see just fine by myself." He says that's the difference between one man's vision of what this means and everybody's vision of what this means. That's what Jesus was teaching. There is no instrument for learning about God like the whole Christian community, and that is why it's a lie that you can be a Christian by yourself. And it is so much the theme of some of the deceitful teaching that's out. No man is an island, said John Donne, neither is any church. We are shaped by the sowing of faithful churches around us and behind us, and we should be humbled by their investments. We tear down our own house if we reflect against that, because our sheep will hear the voice of a hireling and not a shepherd. Well, what is our response? Those are some things I thought about in the story of John 4. I have two things in response. If we realize what we're reaping, I want you to turn to Luke 22. Verse 25. Luke 22:25. Jesus is talking to disciples here, and he said unto them, "The kings of the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and they that exercise authority upon them are called benefactors. But ye shall not be so. But he that is greatest among you, let him be as the younger, and he that is chief as he that doth serve. For whether is greater, he that sitteth at meat or he that serveth? Is not he that sitteth at meat? But I am among you as he that serveth. Ye are they which have continued with me in my temptations, and I appoint unto you a kingdom as my Father hath appointed unto me, that ye may eat and drink at my table in my kingdom, and sit on thrones, judging the 12 tribes of Israel. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan hath desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for thee, that thy faith fail not. When thou art converted, strengthen thy brethren." And my first point here is that we must be converted so that we may sow. Peter was an unlikely champion of the gospel. What does a converted sower or a Mennonite preacher look like? How does he live? Well, he's an example to the believers. And this is a tricky point sometimes. We feel pushed back against the idea that the ordained people, the ordained man of God, the man of the cloth must somehow live on a higher spiritual plane than his flock. It's a double standard. We don't like that. And actually, it's not. It's what Peter said. Peter learned some things. He says, and later in the epistle, he says, what's your job? Well, don't be lords over the flock. Be examples. And be clothed with humility. Is that a higher spiritual plane? No, maybe it's a lower one. I don't know how you want to describe it. But he says, be clothed with humility. Be examples to the flock. There's a proverb that was quoted at some point by Jean-Baptiste Chotard. It applies here, I think. So just accept it for what it is. He said, and he was in the context of the Catholic Church, he said, if a priest is a saint, the people will be fervent. If he be fervent, the people will be pious. If he be pious, the people will at least be decent. If he be only decent, the people will be godless. Don't worry about seeming too pious or preacherish if you're living what you're reading here. Our flocks will not live any more humbly or self-denying life than we do. They won't. We must sow seed. We must have seed in our hands before we can sow. If we're not first lovers of the word, if we're not first enjoying a vibrant personal devotional life as spiritual leaders, our sermons will sound increasingly more plastic and AI generated, and our people will find a better podcast. If it's not in here, they will know when it's in there. We cannot sow seed when our hands are clutching the pride of life. If you want to make sure there's not much left for your children to reap, just be a preacher that lives the American dream. If our properties and our cars are among the finest at church, and our net worth is among the highest in our congregation, we can forget sowing in the kingdom because no one will listen to what we say about discipleship. My last point, let's sow in the kingdom that turned the world upside down, that others may reap after us. Now, at this point, some of you might be feeling uncomfortable because this is sounding awfully Pharisaical. We be Abraham's seed. We have a lot of momentum behind us, and praise the Lord, that creates a wonderful church. Well, I'll just say this. Jesus did condemn the Pharisees for that attitude. And it's true that a steam train goes on down a level track a long time after the firemen stop shoveling coal. It does. Churches coast a long time, too, after the connection between here and the heart and the head has been frayed and deteriorated. They coast a long time. We could be lulled by the momentum of tradition. We could be lulled to sleep. But never against our will. Never against our will. You're not somehow on the cattle cars to Auschwitz. You're not somehow, you know, just a victim of momentum. We fall into apostasy, and churches fall into apostasy when our zeal for discipleship goes out and we have of our own selfishness stopped being willing to bear a cross. When we stop being willing to bear a cross, that's when spiritual pride and apostasy happens. And so the deceivers with all their popular YouTube channels and podcasts are telling our people over and over again that probably Anabaptist tradition is a distraction and certainly it's probably a liability to Christian living and spiritual growth. And too often, I personally feel that it's a tiresome charge by people who are ignorant of church history, for one thing, but much worse than that, they're ignorant of what Jesus already said about it. Jesus already chased people out of the temple for breaking the law. He didn't say burn down the whole Jewish establishment and the law. He said these you ought to have done and not to leave the others undone. The failure of the Pharisees was not that there was religious momentum that they were following carefully and trusting in. It's that they were breaking all the religious momentum. They were breaking all of the laws. And he said, that's your problem. You are heretics. And so if we sow seeds in the kingdom that turn the world upside down, we can stop worrying about coasting to heaven. Jesus said, I'm come to set a man at variance with his family. Does that sound like family pride and spiritual momentum? I'm come to set a man at variance with his family. Jesus was not crucified for doing what made sense. People are crucified for following a way that runs counter to the prevailing direction of culture. That's a quote by Haruas also. And so I say, the reason we're having 500th year commemorative talks on Anabaptism is not because people believed in preserving their heritage for five centuries. It's because any generation in the past 500 years that was willing to take seriously the Sermon on the Mount is going to be a generation plowing deeply against the grain, against the culture, against the expected norms. That's the only reason any Anabaptism still exists 500 years later, not because of spiritual momentum. The Gospels will jar any generation out of complacency. If you feel your flock is drifting, we heard some thoughts about that. If you feel your flock is inclining toward worldly delights, you can be sure they have become disconnected from the Sermon on the Mount. Every time. There is no exception. Because when Jesus says that following me means to deny yourself and bear a cross and live like I lived, how did Jesus live? Live, follow me. Nachfolge Christi was the term the Anabaptists use. Following after Jesus. Well, it's time to close here. You sow, we sow, where we will not reap. And reaping in joy comes only from a lifetime of sowing in tears. And a lot of you know about that, don't you? You do any sowing in tears in your churches? Let's shed our tears that our sons and daughters may reap in joy. Beloved brothers, be steadfast and unmovable, for you know that your labor is not in vain in the Lord, because others will reap after us. Go labor on, spend and be spent. It's our joy to do the Father's will. It is the way the Master went. Should not the servant tread it still?